open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
And in that moment, VI really came to me. I thought, I don't want a parody of Philip Marlowe. I want a woman like me and my friends.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, best-selling crime novelist Sarah Paretsky talks about what it takes to write great fiction.
You need to be willing to face your own shortcomings. I think of writing fiction as a form of auto surgery. The closer you can cut to your own bone, the more authentic your voice will be.
Sarah Paretsky is the author of 16 crime novels featuring her star protagonist, female private eye, V.I. Warshawski. In her latest book, Critical Mass, V.I. uncovers secrets buried in the rubble of World War II. Paretsky spoke with Nancy Baker, who serves as program director of Evanston Scholars in Evanston, Illinois. Paretsky lives in Chicago, the city where most of her books take place.
Chicago feels very vivid to me in that particular way. I came in the summer of 66 and was working in a youth program, a sort of soft propaganda to try to persuade kids that diversity could include something besides rocks. And we would take them, many of them, Chicago, for I'm sure many people here know the city well. It's a very parochial city in a way. People live in their neighborhoods. I'm not sure it's so true now as it was 40 years ago. But we had kids who had never been out of their neighborhood even to see the Christmas store windows downtown. So just getting them on the L, taking them places, it was an adventure. And they'd come back to the church basement where we had our program. And we'd say, what did you see? And we expected them to talk about the high rises or, you know, things that were unusual. But what they saw was close up. They saw drunks on the roof. They saw foxes running alongside the L tracks. And that kind of made a permanent impression on me to see the city with that eye, that close-up eye. And so I guess that's why it's so vivid and real to me.
Do you think your books could be set anywhere else?
My books, V.I. is definitely a shot and a beer kind of person. I don't imagine her in New York or San Francisco. In New York, it's a ruthless and cutthroat town, but it's ruthless and cutthroat in a very sort of, they kill you while you don't even know it's happening. And I don't think she would, I don't want to say she wouldn't survive there. I think she would just start getting out her RPG way too many times.
Well, is there anyone near the front, it's hard to see, who hasn't been to Chicago in maybe 5 years? Anyone? Shout out your name if you haven't been to Chicago in, say, 5 years.
Rebecca.
Okay, Rebecca. So, Rebecca, let's just say, is coming to Chicago next week, and she's got 24 hours to be there. What would you tell Rebecca she has to do that day? And most importantly, where would she have to eat?
Okay. First of all, Rebecca, if you've never taken the architectural boat tour, it's just such a great way to see Chicago's architecture and the changes that have been made in the city since you were last there or if you were never there. And you can do it sitting down, which I think is always a good way to take a tour of, of any place. I loved going down. To me, the Dead Stick Pond, which Nancy briefly mentioned, you don't want to go in the South Side neighborhoods now. They're very unstable. A lot of new gangs have moved in, and it's not so safe. But Dead Stick Pond, 122nd and Stony Island Avenue, I think it says everything about Chicago. It's the last marshlands that still exist in the city limits. You can see migratory birds, herons, all kinds of water birds there. Right next to it, waste management is doing illegal dumping. They have mob ties and so you can, if you're lucky, you can see a confrontation between the environmental, the EPA police, and waste management. If you start in your 24 hours to try to photograph and protest this, they actually will have you stalked by mob heavies who will threaten your life, and that will give you a kind of authentic Chicago experience. And then next to that, cheek by jowl with that, is the landfill where Chicago's garbage was dumped for 100 years. And it's been covered with grass, and it is now the kind of golf course. Bill Clinton helicopters in to play golf on that golf course. So I think you have the wealthy, the nature, the industry, and the ordinary people of the South Side just all living there. And when I take a stranger to the city, I always take them down there because you can't see everything that is Chicago all in one place like that anywhere else. Then where would you eat? Oh, when I first moved to Chicago, there was one restaurant people went to. It was the Black Hawk, and that was where you went for prime rib. Now, it's pretty much what your fancy is. I would send you up to Devon Avenue, 6400 North, the whole other end of the city from Dead Stick Pond, and that's where the Pakistani and Indian immigrants have all of these amazing little storefront restaurants where it's just their cuisine, and if you at all like experimental and if you like spicy, I love it. I love Indian cooking. That would be great. My go-to place, and it's not maybe a VI kind of place, but it's a restaurant across from Oprah's studios called Sardine. It's just, I think of it as my Cheers. It's a French restaurant. It's a bistro. It's very laid back and casual, and it's the place where you go in and everybody knows your name, and you can sit at the bar and have some great wine and eat, and so that's where you'll find me most Monday nights, except when the Bears are playing the Packers.
So, talking about fans, so you're in Hyde Park, which is a near South neighborhood, and yet you're a North Siders fan. You're a Cubs fan, not the Sox.
This is a complicated story. In the first place, as you know, great art is built on suffering. And why would I root for a team where I can't suffer? In the second place, I grew up in the country in rural Kansas. I went to a two-room country school. I played third base for the Kaw Valley District 95 team, and we were always massacred by Wakarusa number 6, which is where Rex Stout went to school, by the way. He grew up in the same part of Kansas that I did just many years earlier. And I, as a child, had a very powerful arm. I could throw the distance from third to first, but I had no aim, and so we were often spending recess looking for our ball, our one ball in the cornfield next to the school. So I kind of feel like not just am I born to be a Cubs fan, I am born to be a Cubs player. But above all, the summer that I came to Chicago and was working with these kids, we were really cheek by jowl with Comiskey Park, and the White Sox would not even return our phone calls, and the Cubs would give us free tickets to the games every Thursday. And as many of you know, the definition in Chicago of an honest politician is one that stays bought. So the Cubs bought my loyalty all those years ago, and I've been paying for it ever since.
Well, you said you were from Kansas, and then you arrived in Chicago. Tell us about 1966, the summer that you met Chicago.
I was 19 years old, and that the whole country was alight in those years with civil rights demonstrations and anti-demonstrations. And I just felt events were happening on the big stage, and I was in Kansas, and I wanted to be part of a bigger universe. They put up a notice for volunteers. I always try to remember how we got information before the internet. We all knew when there was an anti-war demonstration, we would get to Washington, there'd be 100,000 of us on the mall, but how did we know? We didn't text each other. Anyway, I answered the call, and the civil rights leadership in Chicago knew that it was going to be a very volatile summer because Martin Luther King had come to the city and had moved into one of the tenements there to try to give support to the local civil rights movement. They couldn't get any traction in dealing with, really, Chicago had written covenants restricting African Americans to certain segments that they deliberately turned into ghettos, and that's a long story that I won't rant about tonight. But they wanted to embed volunteers in some of the most volatile neighborhoods to try to work with kids and start from the ground up in trying to both control violence in the neighborhoods and change attitudes. So that summer just, it changed my life forever. I mean, it made me committed to the city. It made me committed more than I had been to social justice. It gave me a new appreciation for the ways that big events affect individuals, hurt them in many ways. I was working with kids in a mostly Polish-Lithuanian neighborhood who were just bewildered. They were victimized by banks, by realtors, their families were. They had no power and no control. I didn't have any empathy or sympathy or support for the riots and the violence that they took part in, but I had a lot of sympathy for the helplessness that they felt. And all of those things, it was a long time before I started writing for publication. I used to write very privately for myself, but they all kind of came together to help create my character when I finally did start writing.
VI has a very strong sense of social justice. Are there other traits that she has that you feel you share, such as, I think you said more than once, something about impulse control?
I thought we were talking about puppies at lunch. Yeah, VI and I both have a little problem with impulse control. The difference between us is that she can back it up in ways that I can't. I get in over my head and then I think, oh, when will I ever learn? Actually, VI says the same thing in Critical Mass. There's one scene where she used to date a Chicago cop, a guy named Conrad Rawlings, and he tells her, don't go into this drug house until my pal gets there. And she goes in. Of course she goes in because one thing leads to another. And then as she's in the middle of it all, she thinks, impulse control, when will I ever learn?
Well, do you feel that over the course of reading the different books in the series, though, I feel like she does exercise impulse control. Like, she'll have these contemplative moments where she'll say, in another time or place, I might have acted, but I held my tongue. And does that reflect what you have also found?
I think I've learned over the years that it's good to save your energy for the most important fights that you have. I don't know if I should tell this story or not. At the risk of alienating half the audience, I will say that the day that Bill Gates' fortune hit $100 billion, I was in Seattle on tour and did a live interview on public radio. And they said, what would you do if you had $100 billion? And I said, I would buy Texas and give it back to Mexico. Afterwards, my husband said, you get in enough trouble for things that you really care about. Why did you have to say that?
Well, Victoria Iphigenia Warshawski, that is a mouthful. What is the genesis of that incredible name?
V.I. Warshawski. I always say girl detective because I think of Nancy Drew, who's always referred to as the girl detective. When I first started thinking about VI, I had had a wish for a long time, 8 years before I wrote the first book, to create a woman private eye who turned the tables, who remade the roles of women. But I didn't have confidence that I could actually write. And so what I was doing, I would try these things that were really little parodies of Raymond Chandler that didn't go anywhere. And then one day, a day much like today, a dreary fall day, I worked for CNA Insurance in Chicago. I worked for a guy who was just not, Let's just say he was not a good man. He had his little ways. I would say his only good quality was that he was as awful to the men who worked for him as he was to the women. He was not a sexist. So my lips are saying, gosh, Fred, heck of an idea. And the balloon over my head is saying, Fred, you unspeakable piece of unspeakableness. And in that moment, VI really came to me. I thought, I don't want a parody of Philip Marlowe. I want a woman like me and my friends. She's doing a job that didn't exist for us, for women, when we were growing up, when my generation was growing up. But she says what's in the balloon because she doesn't care about making nice. She doesn't care if she gets fired. And then I had my persona, VI, the non-impulse controlling PI, but I needed a name, and Chicagoans are really obsessed with their place of national origin. To this day, people will say, where are you from? And I'm thinking, they say, well, I grew up in Kansas, but Chicago's been, no, they'll say, where are you from? Meaning, what poverty-stricken square foot of Europe did my ancestors flee? And so she had to have some ethnic identity, and I knew I couldn't write believably about African-American or Latino or really even Irish experience. And one of my grandfathers came from Poland. I thought, well, Warsaw, that's in Poland. Morszowski, that must be a Polish name. And then the initials just came to me. That's why I always call her VI, because I wrote about her for 6 months before I came up with names for her. And poor thing, what was I thinking of to give her those names?
Well, you have another wonderful character who lives downstairs from her, Mr. Contreras, who likes to call her doll and cookie and things like that. Now, is there a symbolic aspect to that name? Because sometimes he is a contrarian, and was that intentional?
I didn't think it through the way I thought through VI's name, so I'm not sure why I called him that. The name is Spanish, but he's Italian because there's a lot of Spaniards in Naples and vice versa. He makes his own horrible grappa that tastes like gasoline, but he's very proud of it. But when I worked for the insurance company, I had an agent on Long Island, a guy named Russ. And when Russ called, you knew that was the rest of your morning, because once he started talking, he went on for a year or two. And he would always call me doll or cookie, which normally I would hate that, but it was like he was talking to his daughter, or it wasn't meant in a put down or condescending or sexually obnoxious way. It just felt comfortable and right coming from him. And so when Mr. Contreras appears in the fourth book, along with the dog, and actually, Mr. Contreras had a cat in that book, and I completely forgot about it. The cat has just... Somebody wrote me recently and said, what happened to Mr. Contreras' cat? And, he gave it to his daughter, Ruthie. It's living in Hoffman Estates. But anyway, I started channeling Russ, and then I got really tired of Mr. Contreras going on and on and on and on, as I am doing right now. Tiring way. So in the sixth book, I shot him. I was going to kill him. But Courtney, my husband, was outraged and jumped in front of the bullet and deflected it into Mr. Contreras's shoulder.
Well, I've also enjoyed, over the course of the series, seeing how you integrated technology and realizing that in the earlier books, sometimes she got into trouble because there were no cell phones. And she was having to call into her answering service and do all these sorts of things that, you know, and then as they progress, she has a cell phone. And so have you looked back over the arc of your books and thought about how technology got her in or out of some of the problems she experienced?
Pre-cell phones and internet, private investigators, at least in fiction, led much more dynamic and dramatic lives. It's really a challenge in the technological world to have the detective be in motion. you know, all the things that she used to do in City Hall and the old records office are now available online. In one book, one of the early books with cell phones, I had her battery run down, but that seemed really cheap and cheesy to me. But lately, because in Critical Mass and also in the previous book, Breakdown, she's grappling with the fact that both the government and sophisticated high-tech companies actually can easily hack into your cell phone and track you wherever you are. And there are places where she has to be quite aware of this and has to go dark in order to be able to circumvent the people who are trying to thwart her. So in a way, the surveillance age is making it possible for the detective once again to have a lot more motion and physicality. You know, I do sometimes wonder about the file that the NSA has on me, because in Critical Mass, there's a detailed description of a meth lab and all the things that you need to make methamphetamines. And I'm thinking, I don't know how to do this. I had to look it all up online, and therefore the NSA knows that I know. You know, it's like I've downloaded the Anarchist's Handbook for advice on how to make bombs out of ammonia and old newspapers. So far, I haven't been stopped at the border, but well, let's not talk about this because I'm being recorded tonight.
Well, VI also likes nice cars, and her cars get better and better as the series goes. Do you also like nice cars?
I have a 1995 red Jaguar convertible, which is my most prized possession, so much so that I have not known whom to leave it to in my estate plan. I finally decided my second stepson, who's a machinist, and he takes apart his computer when it doesn't work and remills the hard drive. He's very green. He doesn't own a car. He makes handmade knives for a living and does custom sharpening. So I've left the car to him because although he might never drive it, he would give it a better engine than...
Well, sometimes you take a break from VI, and you have written other novels, short stories, essays. How do these breaks change you when you come back to VI?
I've written two novels that aren't in the series. One's called Ghost Country, and it's sort of a magic realism novel set in the homeless community or the homeless world in Chicago. And the other, Bleeding Kansas, takes place in the part of rural, I cannot say the word rural, rural Kansas, the country, where I grew up. And both of these were stories that I really wanted to tell that didn't seem to be stories that could be told in VI's voice. And I really think both times that I took a break from her, I came back and wrote about her in a better and fresher, deeper way.
And she's hovering right around 50, isn't she?
She is. Oh. When I started the series, I wanted to age her in real time. I was a big fan of the early Spencer novels, not so much the later ones, but Spencer was a Korean War veteran, and that was important in the early books, and then he didn't age, and it began to seem more and more kind of ludicrous to me. And I thought, well, VI, who she is, her whole life is shaped by the major events of the 20th century. Her mother was a refugee from Mussolini's Italy. Her mother was Jewish. And VI came of age in the great social justice movements of the 70s. But that was before I was aging, before I got creaky. And, you know, I used to look at my mother and think, oh, well, if you only looked after yourself, you wouldn't be. You know, the evil eye follows, the evil eye even more than the NSA follows your thoughts and comes back and bites you. So I did not want VI struggling to get around the way I sometimes struggle to get around. I wanted her to still be active and sexy and leap tall buildings at a single bound and get in over her head because of her lack of impulse control and then fight her way out of it again. So I decided against all of my principles that she would hover around the age of 50 for a while. If I live to be 80 and am still writing. Maybe 60 will start seeming. And then I thought, I'm also at an age where I suffer a lot of loss in my life, as I'm sure many of you do too. And I wanted to keep my fictional world a safe place, not a place of loss. So Lottie Herschel definitely should not be in the operating room anymore, but she will be. She will continue to do that work. I think Mr. Contreras is about maybe 180 now. But he's still going to grab that pipe wrench, and he is not going to suffer from dementia or any of the other terrible things that I see the older people in my life suffering from. And the dogs are just going to stay five forever.
Well, speaking of her needing to stay healthy because she's so scrappy, I mean, she gets into a lot of physical encounters with people. She karate chops bad guys and flies across warehouses on cranes and does all kinds of really cool things. So tell us about a similar VI moment that you had in with a home invader, a potential...
Oh, gosh. Nancy, I think, was recording all of my babbling at lunch. So we live on the south side of Chicago, and we live in an old Victorian house, a brick house. And I came home one day, pulled into my driveway, and saw two kids climbing a tree to get into a second floor window. And I leaped out of the car, my keys in my hand. They jumped down from the tree. I was coming up the tree after them, and they jumped down. And I chased them. I chased them, I guess it was about half a mile. And then they disappeared into this kind of warren of public housing. And I suddenly thought, ooh, maybe I ran a little bit further than I needed to. Meanwhile, my neighbors are crossing the street to get away from me. They're not calling the police or coming to my help. They're like, no, she's demented, get out of the way. And so I streaked back home, and I saw the palm of my hand had been cut to ribbons by my keys. I was so angry and clutching them so tightly. And so I knew that in a fight, the adrenaline, you do not feel the pain. You feel it after the fight. You don't feel it in the middle of the fight. And it kind of helped with when I write about VI's fight scenes. You know, she keeps going. It's afterwards that she's stiff and sore, and Lottie needs to shoot her full of phenylbutazone or something like that. And in Critical Mass, she comes to Lottie. She has to get going, and she wants some steroids injected into her. And Lottie is just totally fed up. She says, first of all, you have to do that in the hospital. You have to have an x-ray over you. It's not something I can do in your living room. And secondly, you have to recover from that. You can't just leap up again. And of course, VI does bully her into at least getting a muscle relaxant, and then she doesn't leap up again because she's pretty groggy, but she does get up again.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Sarah Paretsky reads from her latest book, Critical Mass.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Nancy Baker's conversation with Sarah Paretsky, whose latest book is called Critical Mass.
Well, you have a lot of really interesting and complex white-collar crime, bank fraud, insurance things going on, just all sorts of really interesting kind of bad guys that are at high level, and then you sort of have the goons below it that are trying to beat up VI in her apartment and things like that. You have an MBA. Did your education help you do some of these complex financial crimes?
I have an MBA that I got at the University of Chicago, and it's a very mathematically oriented MBA program, and I did not do well in it, although they did give me the degree. I wouldn't say that per se helped me, but I worked in the financial sector in insurance for 10 years, and I read the journal every day, and I see a lot of these crimes are so complicated, I can't follow them. And I'm in awe, like the state of California just levied a $15 million fine on one of the Koch brothers' shadowy subterranean, yeah, go Jerry Brown, organizations that, and I read the story three times and I still don't exactly follow it, but they have a network of foundations which are not for profit but are used because of the Citizens United decision. They can use them to funnel money into political campaigns, and they just kite money from one fund to the other depending on the state and the state regulations. So I follow that kind of crime, and VI, that's the universe that she operates in. I don't know what else to say about that, but except that financial fraud, to my mind, I mean, street crime, I'm terrified of street crime. Street crime damages lives, it destroys families, there's no doubt about it, it's awful. And I live in a city where children are murdered every day in random shootings, and I think it's terrible, and people do write about that. A lot of mystery writers set their books in that milieu. But I think if you want to do large-scale damage, you do it as a white-collar criminal. You know, like when the savings and loan industry was deregulated, Charles Keating, who owned one of the big S&Ls, targeted his elderly depositors. He found out everyone who was 70 and over, sent out 10,000 letters telling people that his junk bonds were as secure and as safe as the federally insured certificates of deposit that they had. And people lost their life savings. People committed suicide. People went to jail. Elderly people were in jail for shoplifting to feed themselves after he destroyed their lives. And to me, the scale of that is enormous and outrageous, and to the extent that VI can grab hold of a small part of that tiger's tail and make a few lives whole again, then those stories need to be told.
Yeah. Well, I know another issue that you feel strongly about is women in the writing profession. And would you take a minute to just talk to us about Sisters in Crime? I know that's something you're very proud of, and you should be.
When I started writing, when my first book was published, I didn't have big sales. It sold 3,500 copies, but I was very fortunate to be very well reviewed. And that made the difference in my having a career, frankly, and being here tonight. Today, in today's publishing world, they expect you to sell 27,000 hardcover or the equivalent books in order to clear the gate to do a second book. But when I started, the bar was much lower. 2,500 of those copies were sold to libraries. And libraries make their buy decision, even today, based on how many national reviews you get, whether it's print or online today. So if you're not getting reviewed, libraries aren't seeing you're there. And libraries are still the biggest single buyer of books for every writer except the people like Grisham or Cornwell who are selling millions of copies. So I started hearing, though, from other women as I got to know writers in as I went to national meetings, other women were not as fortunate as I was, or Sue Grafton also published her book, her first book, in the same year. And I think it's because Sue and I were doing something that was perceived as masculine, even though we were doing genre-bending, role-changing books, they were still noir, private eye, could be seen as part of that world. So Sisters in Crime, I was hearing from a lot of women who were, it used to be if you went to a National Crime Writers Conference, there was a panel of women writers, and then everything else was discussed by men. And we were just starting to hear a lot about these kinds of issues. One woman went to a crime conference, and the man on the panel with her said, "What do you do when your kitty cat gets on your keyboard?" And it's like, you know, who needs that? So in 1986, at the big crime convention, the BoucherCon in Baltimore, I hosted a breakfast to see if there was enough interest in these problems to organize, and 26 people came, and out of that, Sisters in Crime grew. The first thing that we did was to do a monitor of all of the National Review outlets. We had volunteers who just tracked the books that were reviewed by men versus by women. We got the number of books published that year in the crime fiction field, and we found that adjusting for the numbers, I mean, men were publishing about 60% of the crime novels. A book by a man was 7 times more likely to be reviewed than a book by a woman. And we thought, well, maybe men write twice as well as we do, but we don't think they write 7 times as well as we do. So we went to the industry. We couldn't be confrontational because we need them. We need the review outlets. We need the publishers. But we just started doing it by education. We did a books in print. We went directly to libraries. We went directly to bookstores. We really changed the landscape of the publishing world. We grew the mystery. We brought women readers back into the mystery who had abandoned it because there weren't books that they could read and identify with. Men started liking the way that women were depicted and playing roles, and men started writing about interesting women. And so, yeah, I am very proud of this because I think that the work that we did, and I mean, I started the organization, but a lot of women did a lot of hard work. Linda Grant and Carolyn Hart did the books in print. The work that we've done has really, it's helped the genre, it's helped the industry, it's helped readers. It saved the economy, it ended war.
So, Sarah, do you have a female protagonist. Do you simply have a female protagonist, or do you consider yourself a feminist writer?
I consider myself a writer who is a feminist, and I try, when I'm writing, to think empathically about all of my characters, even those who take positions that are very different from my own. I'm not always successful at it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think the books that I have the most regrets about are the ones where the characters who don't share my outlook are treated too two-dimensionally. This is what I think you need to be a good writer. You need to love language. You need to love playing with words. You need to read a lot because that's your raw material. You need to be willing to face your own shortcomings. I think of writing fiction as a form of auto-surgery. The closer you can cut to your own bone, the more authentic your voice will be. And you have to develop an empathy for yourself and for the people around you. I think my writing is a work in progress. I would like to be a better writer than I am. I would like to be freer and write more poetically and all these things, but these are the things that I think you need to be a good writer. I think someone like Saul Bellow, who had an incredible gift of language, to me, his books are unreadable because his anger and his lack of empathy for everyone, it distorts them and turns them into screeds. And I don't want to write like that myself. And sometimes I do, and then I'm not writing well.
Well, let's transition to critical mass. And would you like to tell us something about some of the travels and research that you had to do? Where did it take you, and what did you find while you were writing it?
A lot of the work that I did was just very much out of books. I'm married to a particle physicist, Courtney served with great gallantry in the Second World War as a member of the Royal Navy. He saw action at Normandy and elsewhere. But at the war's end, he came to the United States and did a PhD in physics at Berkeley, and then was brought to the University of Chicago by Enrico Fermi, and was a protege of Fermi's, and through him met many of the people, most of the people, who worked on the Manhattan Project. So when I came into his life a number of years later, it was my privilege to meet a lot of those people. And yeah, the horrible thing at the end of the road is the bomb, but the excitement that physicists, the ones that I know, knew, feel when they're wholly engaged in this work, it's something that, on our first date, Courtney tried to explain special relativity to me. And what made me fall in love with him was how alive he was. This wasn't work to him. This was something beyond joy. It was where his heart was, and he wanted me to share that. And for a long time after I started writing, I wanted to try to put that on the page. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much, but I'll try to make this shorter. So. But it took me a long time to get characters in a story that would make that possible. And critical mass is the end of a lot of thinking, playing with ideas, and creating a physicist who had her career in Vienna in the 1930s. I'm going to say just a little bit more about that, and then I'm going to shut up and read a little. I started learning just in a fortuitous way about an institute in Vienna that was part of the University of Vienna, where 40% of the research staff before World War II were women. And this was because the director of the institute cared so much about having women involved in science. His own most frequent collaborator was a woman. And he brought these women in. The university wouldn't pay them. He paid them out of his own pocket. When Hitler came in, of course, all of the Jews at the institute either had already fled or had to flee or were killed. And the women had to go home because the Nazis didn't believe in women working outside the home. So Vienna has never recovered from this. The university has never recovered from this. It's still a place where people move and think very cautiously. I went there. The director of the institute today talked about this very frankly, that even 70 years after the war, that's still the big cloud over how creative. That is, they don't feel creative. They go overseas to do work, but in their institute, they feel still very cautious and not risk-taking in science. So I spent time there. I imagined having a chase scene there. I knew where it was going to be. I wrote it all out. It's some of the worst writing I ever have done. And I kind of realized that my action scenes had to be in Chicago, my background scenes had to be in Vienna. I went to the Leopoldstadt, which is an island off of Vienna where a lot of Jews historically lived. It's where Billy Wilder, the director, film director, grew up. Freud was born there. A lot of people were there, but the Nazis turned it into a ghetto. And I have photographs on my own webpage of the building that I chose for where Lottie Herschel's family was forced to move and live. It's now a big Turkish neighborhood. I also had to get naked in the Vienna airport. As I went through security on my way out, the underwire on my bra set off the alarm. And they ran the wands over me. And that wasn't good enough. They took me into this cabin and told me to take off all my clothes. And you know, I don't think anyone would enjoy that. For a Jew in Vienna with people in uniform telling her to get naked, it was singularly uncomfortable. But I decided I really wanted to catch my plane, and so I did it. I don't know what VI would have done.
So you've got a couple of excerpts for us to hear.
The little segment that I'm going to read from VI's part is in the present. So Kitty has a daughter in her 50s who's a drug addict, and Lottie's in surgery when Kitty calls thinking that her daughter's life is being threatened. And VI is told by Lottie's clinic manager to go try to find the daughter. And VI ends up in a meth house. And I'm not going to describe all of that. It's in my NSA file. So she's been out in the country. She's gone through this house. I don't want to read too much
in
the
interest. It's a good description, though. For all of you who like Breaking Bad, it's a really good, the whole meth things.
Well, I'll read a little of it. I just don't want to take up too much time. A house near the house where I grew up is kind of like this. I'm sorry. My brother just got a new dog, and he said they were deciding between a black lab, a golden lab, and a meth lab. The house was old and falling down. Glass had broken out or been shot out of most of the windows. Someone had nailed slabs of plywood over them, but hadn't put much effort into the job. In several places, the wood swung free, secured by only a couple of nails. The steel fence had revolving spikes on top to discourage trespassers like me. Signs warned of guard dogs, but I didn't hear any barking or snuffling as I walked the perimeter. It was behind a dilapidated shed that I found the opening I needed. Someone had been there before me with heavy steel cutters, taking out a piece of fence wide enough for a car to drive through. As I passed between the cuts, the skin on my neck prickled with something more than heat. I wished I'd brought my gun with me, but I hadn't known I was coming to a drug house when I left Chicago. Whoever cut the fence had dealt with the back door in a similarly economic way, kicking it in so that it hung on one hinge. The smell that rolled out the open door, metallic, like iron mixed with rotting meat, was all too easy to recognize. I pulled my shirt up over my nose and looked cautiously inside. A dog lay just beyond the doorway, his chest blown open. Some large caliber something had taken him down as he tried to protect the losers he lived with. Poor old Rottweiler. Your mama never meant you to guard a drug house, did she? Not your fault, boy. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong people. And she covers his body with a towel. When I stepped over him, it was into a kitchen from hell. A scarred wooden hutch, once painted white, was filled with spray cans of starter fluid, drain cleaner, jars part full of ugly-looking liquids, eyedroppers, Vicks inhalers, and gallon jugs labeled muriatic acid. A makeshift hood with an exhaust vent had been constructed over the hutch. I played my light around the room. It was hard to tell how much of the shambles had been caused by the dog killers and how much by the natives. I stepped over jugs that had been knocked to the floor, skirted a couple of plug-in heaters, and moved into the rooms beyond. It was an old farmhouse with a front room that had once been a formal parlor. Judging by the remnants of decorative tiles around the empty fireplace, these had been pried out of the mantle and shattered. Someone had held target practice against an old roll-top desk. An angry hand had smashed the drawers and scattered papers around the floor. A staircase led to a second floor. Tucked underneath it was a stopped-up toilet. A better detective than I might have looked inside, but this smell told me more than I wanted to know. I climbed partway down the steep stairs to the basement, but a spider the size of my hand scuttling from my flashlight kept me from descending all the way. Most likely, if there had been anything to find in this ruined house, the dog's killers already had it. In my days with the public defender, I used to see this kind of destruction with depressing frequency. Most likely, the invaders had been hunting for more drugs, or they felt the dealers had done them out of something. The addicts I worked with would have traded their mother's wedding ring for a single hit and then come back to shoot up the place so they could retrieve their jewelry. I'd represented one woman who killed her own son when he couldn't get back the ring he'd traded for a rock of crack. I was skirting the fence, heading back to the road, when I heard a faint whimper from the collapsed shed. I pushed my way through weeds and rubble and pulled apart the siding. Another Rottweiler lay there. When it saw me, it feebly thumped its stub of a tail. I bent slowly. It made no effort to attack as I felt its body. A female, painfully thin, she'd gotten tangled in a mess of old ropes and fence wires. She'd panicked and worked herself deep into the makeshift net. I slowly pried the wires away from her chest and legs. When I moved away and squatted, hand out, she got to her feet to follow me, but collapsed again after a few steps. I went to my car for my water bottle and a rope. I poured a little water over her head, cuffed my hand so she could drink, tied the rope around her neck. Once she was rehydrated, she let me lead her slowly along the fence to the road. But when we reached my car, she wouldn't get in. I tried to lift her, but she growled at me, bracing her weak legs in the weeds along the verge. I dropped the rope and watched as she staggered across the gravel. At the cornfield, she sniffed among the stalks until she found what she was looking for. She headed into the corn, but was so weak that she kept falling over. How about if you stay here and let me find what you're looking for? She looked at me skeptically, not sure a city woman could find her way through a field, but unable to go on herself. The stalks were higher than my head, but they were brown and dry and didn't provide any shield from the sun. All around me, insects zinged and stung. Prairie dogs and a snake slipped away at my approach. The plants were set about a yard apart, the rows appearing the same, no matter what direction I looked. It would have been easy to get lost, except I was following a trail of broken stalks toward the spot where crows continued to circle. The body was splayed across the corn like a snow angel. Crows were thick around the shoulders and hands, and they turned on me with savage cries. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Well, we would love to turn this over to you now and have some question and answers.
Hello, my name is Lynn. I have always wondered what you thought about this, and I never thought I'd have a chance to ask. What about Kathleen Turner?
What about Kathleen Turner and the V.I. Warshawski movie? Well, I went through the predictable stages of denial, anger, acceptance. The movie was, in some ways, a good experience for me. It brought my books to readers who had never heard of them, and especially in the Far East, it made a difference in introducing readers to V.I. It just wasn't a good movie, and the hard part is that I didn't realize when I signed the contract that I had given the rights in perpetuity to Disney, and Disney doesn't want to do anything with them, and they don't want to give them up. So the mouse is being a bit of a rat. But I will say there were two moments in the filming that were really great. One of them was that Disney rented Wrigley Field for a day's shooting, and you are not allowed on those sacred grounds. You just aren't. And I got to be on the grass at Wrigley Field. It was in the days when Andre Dawson was playing right field. I got to kiss the ground where Andre Dawson's feet had stood. And then movies are a lot like police work. You just sit around waiting, and then there's a brief flurry of action, and then you wait more. So they had extras in the stand, and I was just horsing around, like, you know, as I was doing at the start of this program, singing opera on the stage. I decided to run the bases. And the extras were just glad that there was something going on, so they were cheering. It was night, the lights were on. I'm running the bases at Wrigley Field under the lights. And I got to home plate, and I wanted to slide. I don't know how to slide, so I just fell onto home plate. And I thought, I get it. I get why athletes don't retire. Here I am. I'm not athletic. And yet, that cheering, I would have gone on forever to hear those cheers. So there was that moment, which was wonderful, and then a funny moment where some big studio chief, it wasn't Michael Eisner, but someone at just the next level below, came in to see how the filming was going, watched the day's shooting, and came out and said, you know, feminism might be commercially viable. And I don't know, that was kind of worth hearing. But Jeff Lurie, the producer, I mean, he could have made a good movie, and he didn't. He made a bad movie. Jeff Lurie now owns, this is how petty and impotent I am. Jeff Lurie owns the Philadelphia Eagles. I watch him in the owner's box during Eagles games, and he's gotten kind of round and shiny the way people are when they've been on expense accounts too long. And I think, yeah, you're gonna have a heart attack one of these days, Jeff Lurie. That's gonna teach you a thing or two. And the other thing I do is I don't care who the Eagles are playing, even if they're playing the Cowboys, I root for whoever is playing the Eagles. I mean, yeah, serve you right, Jeff Lurie, your team just lost again. So that is how impotent I am and was in the face of what Disney did to VI. Now, aren't you glad you asked?
We are. Well, I think that concludes our evening. And thank you so much. That was...
That was Sarah Paretsky at the National Writers Series, talking with Nancy Baker. Paretsky has written 16 crime novels featuring female private detective V.I. Warshawski, the latest of which is Critical Mass. Thanks to Joe Bayers at the Traverse City Opera House. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.